Father, and thank all of you for coming. And I'm very happy to be here. What I wanted to do this evening was begin with my witness testimony to give a little background and set the stage, and then talk a little bit about the way that the Catholic Church is the continuation and fulfillment of Judaism. And in fact, because of the time of year and because it's Lent and Holy Week and Good Friday and Easter are coming up, to perhaps talk a little bit about how that is really the central point of the meeting between Judaism and the Catholic Church, because in fact, as you all know, the Last Supper was a Passover Seder, and it was also the first Catholic Mass. And so it really is the one point in time where one can see Judaism being transformed into the Catholic Church. So I think I'll head in that direction after I give my witness testimony. As Father mentioned, my parents were both German Jews who left Hitler's Germany. My father left shortly after Hitler came to power. There was a short period when he was encouraging Jews to leave. My mother's family was less fortunate. They fled to France. France fell under the Third Reich. And my mother was actually arrested by the Gestapo and put on a train to a concentration camp. But she escaped and made it to the United States. So I was born and raised Jewish in the United States, quite Jewish, quite religiously Jewish, and also entirely socially Jewish, because there was less mixing in those days than today, and all of my family's friends were Jewish, all of my parents' friends were Jewish, all of my friends were Jewish, and so forth. And I took my Judaism very seriously. And then I went to MIT for a science degree, and I lost my faith at university, largely under the pseudoscientific, arrogant worldview that science has all the answers and religion is a medieval superstition that people made up before they had science to explain everything. And anything that science can't explain today, it will be able to in 5 years. I'll make a little digression. That's the opposite of a scientific view, because the essence of science is you start with the evidence, you form a theory that explains the evidence. If that theory fails to explain the evidence, you have to throw away that theory and come up with another theory that does explain the evidence. And all of the evidence, frankly, is for the Catholic faith. Science has no answers. Materialistic science has no answers to, for instance, the medical miracles at Lourdes, the medical healings at Lourdes that are miraculous, or to the miracle at Fatima, which was seen by 70 to 100,000 people, or the Shroud of Turin, which if all the scientists or all the engineers in the world today got together, they still couldn't duplicate the Shroud of Turin. They couldn't counterfeit it, and so forth. So in fact, a truly scientific view would lead one to the Catholic faith. It's a pseudo-scientific, actually anti-scientific view, to claim that a scientific view, you know, requires leaving the Catholic faith. G.K. Chesterton has a quote that I like, which is, "Rightly or wrongly, those who believe in miracles believe in them on the basis of the evidence, and rightly or wrongly, those who disbelieve in miracles refuse to believe in them on the basis of faith." Right? So, but anyway, I didn't know this when I was at MIT, and I believed the scientific arrogance, and I lost my faith. I went on to Harvard Business School. I did well enough there, so I was invited back to join the faculty shortly after graduation. And so I found myself at the relatively young age of 29 as a newly minted professor of marketing at Harvard Business School. And that's really where my witness testimony begins. I don't know if you have that expression here. Witness testimony is the standard phrase for one's conversion story or giving witness to how one came to the Lord. Anyway, what was happening was that all my life, from when I was a small child, I knew there had to be a real meaning and purpose to life, and that one day when I got older, I would come to know the real meaning and purpose to life. As a child, I thought that would come from entering into a personal relationship with God, which I honestly thought would happen at my bar mitzvah. The bar mitzvah is the Jewish parallel, quite fairly parallel to Catholic confirmation. When the child is about 13, he undergoes a ritual in the synagogue and enters religious adulthood. And I honestly thought that at my bar mitzvah, I would come come into a personal relationship with God, and when that didn't happen, it was actually one of the saddest days in my childhood. But then I decided that the meaning of life would come when I got a driver's license, or when I began university, or if I got into Harvard Business School, or when I began my career, or so forth. But here I was more successful in a worldly sense than I ever expected to be, being a professor at Harvard, but life still had no meaning or purpose. And so I fell into the deepest kind of existential despair of my life. You know, here, you know, I believe the scientific myth that life was just a chemical accident that happened a few billion years ago, and you know, we just like evolved out of the slime, and there's no meaning or purpose to anything, and when we die, that's it, and so forth. And yet, at this point in my life, there was nothing more I could look forward to that I could imagine would give my life meaning, because I was already relatively successful. And so in this despair, I was walking in nature early one morning, and I received the single most spectacular grace of my life. I was just walking along, this was the sand dunes behind the beach near where I lived, and I lost my thoughts. I had long since lost any belief in God, and from one moment to the next, the veil between earth and heaven disappeared, and I found myself in the presence of God, very knowingly in the presence of God, seeing my life as though I had died and was looking back over my life in the presence of God. And I saw in an instant how I would feel about everything after I died. I saw that my two greatest regrets when I died would be, number one, all of the time and energy I had wasted worrying about not being loved, when every moment of my existence I was held in an ocean of love greater than I ever imagined could exist, coming from an all-knowing, all-loving God. And the other great regret would be every hour that I had wasted doing nothing of value in the eyes of heaven. I saw that it was all true, that every action has a moral content that's observed and recorded and matters for all eternity. I saw that everything that had ever happened to me had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged, coming from the hands of this all-knowing, all-loving God, not only including those things that had caused the most suffering at the time, but especially those things that had caused the most suffering at the time. I saw that actually the most powerful aspect of this experience was coming into such an immediate awareness that God knew me by name. More than that, that he had been watching over me every moment of my existence, that he was caring about me as though I were the only person he had ever created, that he had not only been controlling everything that happened to me, but he knew how I felt at every moment and cared about how I felt at every moment, and in some very real sense was sad at everything that made me sad and was happy at everything that made me happy. I knew, as I said, that we live forever, and that here I was so worried about life having no meaning, when the opposite was true. Every moment has the potential for moral action, and if we take advantage of that potential and do a moral action for the good, we will very literally be rewarded for it for all eternity. And if we let that opportunity go by, it will be a lost opportunity for all eternity. I saw that all my life I've been not only selfish, but stupidly selfish, because I had been concerned about accumulating things that wouldn't do me any good even 100 years from now after I'm dead, when if I wanted to be smart and selfish, I should be essentially putting all my energy into accumulating riches for heaven, which would benefit me very literally 100 million years from now. The image that I had at the time was as though all my life I had been like greedily working for Monopoly money, you know, just a brightly colored paper bits in a game of Monopoly, when right next to it there was a stack of solid gold coins that I could have been working for instead. So I knew that the meaning and purpose of my life was to worship and serve my Lord and Master and God who was revealing himself to me. I didn't know who he was or what religion to follow. I couldn't think of him as the God of Judaism. I know that he was the God of Judaism, but in all honesty, if you read the Old Testament, the picture of God that emerges is of a God far more distant and severe and judgmental than this God was. And in fact, not only is that the picture in the Old Testament, but it's actually the theology in the Old Testament. That God in the Old Testament did not talk to the common people. He only spoke to the priests and the prophets. And there's even a prophecy, I believe it's in the book of Joel, where God says, the day is coming when you won't have to go to these people and say, tell me about God, because I'll make myself known to every manservant and maidservant. And of course, that prophecy was referring to Christ, was referring to Christianity. So the relationship between God and man actually changed with Christianity. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So all I wanted to know who this God was and what religion to follow to worship him properly. So I prayed at the time. I was still walking during this experience. I could see I could see into the spiritual world, into heaven, but I could also still see the physical world. It was as though, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but sometimes when you go to the theater, you know, you might be in the audience of the theater and the lights are on and you see the curtain in front of the stage, and then the house lights go down and they shine a light on the front of the curtain and you still only see the curtain. And then they dim that light and they turn on the stage lights behind the curtain, and all of a sudden the curtain becomes transparent and you see onto the stage. And that's what this was like. It was like I still saw the physical world, but it was like a transparent curtain, and I saw behind it into the real world, into heaven. And I wasn't amazed when this was happening that I could see the spiritual world. All I was amazed at was that I could ever have not seen it, because it was so much more substantial, so much realer, so much more immediate than the physical world, that I just could not wrap my mind around how I could have ever been blind to it. And it never occurred to me during this experience. I couldn't imagine ever being blind to it again, because its presence was so much more substantial than the physical world. So anyway, I was still walking, as I said. I prayed on the spot. I said, let me know your name so I know what religion to worship and serve you properly. I don't mind if you're a Buddha and I have to become a Buddhist. I don't mind if you're Krishna and I have to become Hindu. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan, as long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian. And I literally prayed that, and he didn't reveal his name to me. I obviously wasn't ready to hear it at the time. But I went back home, happy for the first time since childhood. I knew we lived forever. I knew there was never any reason to be anxious about anything. I knew that, you know, every day, every hour of life had this incredibly, you know, potential meaning that one could take advantage of for all eternity and so forth. And all I wanted to do was know who this God was who revealed himself to me, so I would know what religion to follow and grow closer to him and worship him properly and serve him properly. So every night before going to sleep, I would say a short prayer that I had made up to know the name of my Lord and Master and God who had revealed himself to me that day. And a year to the day after that initial experience, and I know it was exactly a year to the day because I know that I, before this happened, I mean, I remember praying before going to sleep that night in thanksgiving for what had happened a year earlier. I went to sleep. I thought I was woken by a hand gently on my shoulder and led to a room and left alone with the most beautiful young woman I could ever imagine. And I knew without being told that it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. And when I found myself in her presence, all I wanted to do was throw myself on my knees and somehow honor her appropriately, to be in her presence, to feel the love that flowed from her, was to be in a state of ecstasy greater than I ever imagined could exist. And as beautiful as she was to look at, even more transporting actually was the sound of her voice, which was sort of pure love and pure music, and just flowed through me and lifted me up into the state of ecstasy. And the first thing she said to me was she offered to answer any questions that I might have for her. So, as I said, when I found myself in her presence, all I wanted to do was honor her and worship her appropriately. The first thought that crossed my mind was, oh my goodness, I wish I at least knew the Hail Mary. But I didn't, so when she offered to answer any questions I might have for her, I sort of wanted to ask her to teach me the Hail Mary, but I was too proud to admit that I didn't know it. So instead, as a kind of indirect way of getting her to tell it to me, I asked her what her favorite prayer to her was. And her initial answer was a little bit coy. It was, "I love all prayers," to me. But I was a little bit pushy, and I said, "But you must love some more than others." And she relented, and she recited a prayer, but she said it in Portuguese, and I didn't know any Portuguese. So all I could do was make the effort to remember the first few syllables phonetically. And the next morning when I woke up, I wrote them down phonetically. And then later when I met a Portuguese Catholic woman, I asked her to recite all of the prayers to Mary in Portuguese so that I could identify the prayer. And to the best of my ability, I identified as, "O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us, have recourse to thee." I asked her about four or five other questions. I'll mention a couple of them now. Most of the questions were inspired, so to speak, by simply being overwhelmed by her love and by her gloriousness. And so at one point I kind of stammered out, "How can it be? How is it possible? How can it be that you're so magnificent, that you're so exalted, that you're so glorious? How can it be?" And her answer was just to look down at me almost pityingly and shake her head gently. And she said, "Oh no, you don't understand. You don't understand anything. I'm nothing. I'm a creature. I'm a created being. He's everything." And I'll mention at least one more question and answer, again, out of the same desire to honor her appropriately. I asked her what title she liked best for herself. And her response was, "I am the beloved daughter of the Father, mother of the Son, and spouse of the Spirit." So then I asked her about three or four other questions, which she answered. And then she said she had something she wanted to tell me about, talk to me about. And she spoke to me for about another 10 or 12 minutes. And then the audience was over and I went back to sleep. Let me say two things. One is, I know now, I didn't know then, but I know now that while this was happening, if there had been a camera in my bedroom, it would have shown me asleep in bed, that this took place in the context of being asleep. I didn't think that was the case at the time. It didn't feel that way. My memory doesn't represent it that way. You know, I remember the feeling of standing there, of weighing different questions in my mind. You know, what about this question? What about that question? I remember the conversation word for word and so forth. And the next morning when I woke up, I knew an awful lot more than I had known before I was asleep. But nonetheless, strictly speaking, this was a dream experience. This was at least an out-of-body experience. So anyway, the next morning when I woke up, I knew who the Blessed Virgin Mary was. I knew her incredibly exalted stature. As a matter of fact, I'll tell this. I don't usually tell this, but I'll tell this. The thing that ended the audience was I began to worship her, actually. I couldn't help it. And as soon as my heart began to kind of worship her, she kind of excused herself and left. Now, in my own defense, I'll say that whenever an angel appeared to man in either the Old or New Testament, the initial response was for that person to fall down on his face and begin to worship the angel. I think it happened to the evangelist John. When the angel appeared to him and he fell down and began to worship him until the angel said, "Get up, I'm only a creature like you." And we know that the Blessed Virgin Mary is the queen of angels, that she's actually has a higher stature than the highest of the angels. So I don't know if you want to take my word for it or not, but it's a very easy error to fall into when one is actually exposed to her grandeur. It's very, very hard to understand that she's a human being like we are. So anyway, that's actually what precipitated the end of the audience. But so the next morning, when I woke up, I knew having Christ on the beach. I knew I wanted, that walk had taken place, as I said, on the dunes behind the beach. I knew that I wanted nothing other than to be as fully and completely Christian as possible. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know the difference between a Protestant and a Catholic. And there wasn't much I could do other than open a local phone book and find a But I knew who the Blessed Virgin Mary was, and that led me fairly directly into the Catholic Church. So that's really my witness testimony, or relatively short version of my witness testimony. I'm not here to sell things, despite my ethnic background, but I do have CDs and DVDs back there, if people want, you know, and either a recording of this or a longer version of my witness testimony. I will also say, by the way, as long as I'm saying that, I have a website, salvationistfromthejews.com, which is the title of my first book. By the way, I know that you people all know it, but I have gotten in trouble for saying that salvation is from the Jews. And I actually was once at a conference. It was a kind of traditionalist Catholic conference in France. And a very indignant traditionalist Catholic came up to me and picked up the book and said, "Salvation is from the Jews. I've never heard anything more disgusting in my life." And I said, "Oh, really? Those are words straight from the mouth of Jesus." So that kind of set him back. That's John 4:22, when Jesus is speaking to the Samaritan woman at the well. He says, "Salvation is from the Jews." So anyway, I have a website, salvationsfromthejews.com, and I have all of the video and CDs that I'm selling back there up on the website for free, you know, for download or to watch. And I will put tonight's talk up on the website to listen to for free too, because I'm at least half converted. So that's the end of my witness testimony. So I'll go into the relationship between Judaism and the Catholic Church, and try to center it a little bit around Good Friday and Easter and Passover. Now, when I entered the church, I was a little bit surprised when I would come across a cradle Catholic, somebody born and raised Catholic, who would come up to me and sort of throw open their arms wide and say, "Welcome to our church," when they heard that I was a Jew who had become Catholic. Because I couldn't help feeling that if the Catholic faith is true, it should be me opening up my arms wide and saying to them, "Welcome to my church." Because if the Catholic faith is true, the Catholic Church is nothing but the continuation, the fulfillment of Judaism after the coming of the Jewish Messiah, I should say. It's all one story. It's one story of salvation history that begins in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve and won't end until the second coming. And it's one plan, one and the same plan that God had for the salvation of humanity, which by its very nature exists in two phases. The first phase, which is the preparatory phase, to prepare the world for the incarnation, which is Judaism, and the second phase, which is the fulfillment of that preparation, which is the Catholic Church. Let me back up and explain what I'm talking about. The story begins quite literally with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. When God created man, he created him to live in a state of continual intimacy with God, bliss, no death, no sickness, even no work and so forth, from his creation for all eternity. When man chose to sin, that initial privileged relationship between God and man was shattered. But at that very moment, God knew that not only would he someday restore man to that original exalted state, but would actually elevate him to an infinitely higher state through the incarnation of the second person of the Most Holy Trinity as a man at a future point in time. If the second person of the Most Holy Trinity was going to incarnate as a man at a future point in time, it would be at a particular point in time, among a particular people, in a particular place in the world, even in the womb of a particular virgin, and of course that people would have to be prepared. They would have to be separated out from all the other people on the face of the earth. They would have to be given a means to stay separate for centuries and centuries and centuries while they were given a tremendous amount of divine revelation, so that they could be prepared for the incarnation. They would have to be taught about the one true uncreated creator God. They would have to be taught about the creation of man, the fall of man, the seriousness of sin, the need for redemption, the future coming of a redeemer. They would have to be given enough divine revelation to recognize the redeemer when he came, and they would have to be given a deep enough understanding of theology to make sense of what was happening and to spread that religion to the four corners of the earth after it happened. And that's just what the Jewish people were. They were the people chosen, one could say, at random from all the people on the earth for that task, which had the, in some sense, sole purpose of, well, let me put it another way. The sole purpose for God choosing the Jews is because he had to choose somebody, separate them out from humanity, and give them a tremendous amount of divine revelation to prepare the way for the incarnation and to prepare the way for the spreading of the gospel to the four corners of the earth. Now, and by the way, if they had to stay separate for 2,000 years, which it turned out they did, and in those days, of course, pretty much everyone in that part of the world was a nomadic tribe. You know this from reading the Old Testament. Constantly warring against each other, absorbing each other, intermarrying, and so forth. They would also have to be given a means to stay separate for almost 2,000 years. And this is somewhat speculative, but I think one can look at the laws that God gave the Jews in the Old Testament, the laws about ritual purity and eating and so forth, and one can imagine that part of the intention of those laws was to give them a mechanism for staying separate, because it's hard to dissolve into another people's if you're not allowed to touch them or eat with them or anything. And one could even imagine that God gave them some personality attributes, which we might see reflected in the New Testament, like being stubborn and hard-headed and so forth, for the purpose of staying separate for 2,000 years so that they could fulfill this task. One can ask, why did God choose the Jewish people for this role, which was undoubtedly the most important single role ever entrusted to a single ethnic group? And there are at least three reasons, three answers to that question. One is, God had to choose somebody, and whoever he chose, today we'd be asking, why on earth did he choose them? But another reason, we know from our Catholic theology or experience, that the normal pattern of God is precisely to choose the most worthless and insignificant people for his special gifts and graces, precisely so that it's evident to everyone, when those graces come about, that they could have done nothing to deserve them, but they were an unmerited gift of God. An example of this is the Sacred Heart apparitions. When Jesus appeared to St. Margaret Mary Alacoque in the Sacred Heart apparitions, St. Margaret Mary Alacoque asked Jesus at one point, why did you choose me for this honor? And Jesus said, that's very simple. If I could have found anyone else more worthless and insignificant than you, I would have chosen her instead. Now, the fact that that's why God chose the Jews, it turns out, is explicit in the Old Testament. In Ezekiel chapter 16, it says, thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, on the day you were born, your navel string was not cut, nor were you washed with water to cleanse you, nor rubbed with salt, nor swathed with bands. And when I passed you by and saw you weltering in your blood, I said to you, in your blood, live. Then I bathed you with water and washed off your blood. I anointed you with oil. I clothed you with embroidered cloth and shod you with leather. I swathed you with fine linen and covered you with silk. And your renown went forth among the nations because of your beauty, for it is perfect through the splendor which I have bestowed upon you, says the Lord God. So God is comparing the Jewish people to the most worthless and insignificant of people, a baby cast away immediately after birth to die, not even being washed at the afterbirth. And God's comparing the Jewish people to that and saying, you know, I found you in that worthless, discarded state, and I gave you this, and I did this to you, and I raised you up. So it's, again, it's just like that story with Margaret Mary Alacoque that he's saying he chose the Jewish people precisely because of how insignificant it is. But there's also a positive reason why God chose the Jewish people, and that's going to lead us into this little bit of a discussion about the Last Supper and why the Last Supper was a Passover Seder and why the First Mass was a Passover Seder and why Jesus had to be crucified on Passover. And so it will be serve as a vehicle for tying everything together. So let me start that story at the beginning of that story, which is at the very beginning of the Jewish people, which is God's call to Abraham and Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his only legitimate son, Isaac. I think you know the story. It's in Genesis. God called Abraham. At the time, Abraham was a pagan. He was in the land of Ur of the Chaldeans. God made himself known to Abraham and and said, I want you to leave your homeland and take your wife and go where I tell you. So Abraham left his homeland. Oh, and I will make you the father of a great nation. So Abraham left his homeland with his wife and went to where God told him, which was ended up being Israel, and waited and waited and waited for this child, for the son through whom God would make him the father of a great nation. Well, he waited and waited and waited, and nothing happened because his Sarah was infertile. And she didn't bear Abraham a son. And then finally, when Sarah was about 80 and Abraham close to 100, God miraculously gave them a son, Isaac, who was the son of the promise through whom Abraham would be the father of a great nation. And as soon as Isaac became an adolescent, God turned around and said to Abraham, now that you've waited all your life for the son of promise that I have finally given you, I want you to turn around and sacrifice him to me. And without a moment's hesitation, Abraham agreed. And that's where we pick up the story. It's in Genesis 22, and let me read some verses from it. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. Abraham replied, here I am. God said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took his son Isaac, and went to the place God had told him. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, and laid it on the shoulders of Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife, and they both went together up the mountain. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, I see the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham said, God himself will provide the lamb for the sacrifice, my son. When they came to the place God had told him, Abraham built an altar there, laid the wood in order, and bound Isaac his son on the wood. Then Abraham put forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide, as it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. And the angel of the Lord called Abraham a second time from heaven and said, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will indeed bless you, and I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and the sand on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies, and in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. This promise that God made to Abraham, because Abraham is willing to sacrifice his only legitimate beloved son to God, this promise God made, in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, has always been understood in Jewish theology as the promise to send the Messiah. That this was the moment when God promised to Abraham to send the Messiah through his seed, which is what, of course, made Abraham the father of the Jewish nation. Now, that mountain, which in the days of the Old Testament was called Mount Moriah, 2,000 years later had a different name. It was Mount Calvary. It's one and the same mountain. If you ever are so blessed as to go to Jerusalem, you can go to the top of the Temple Mount. You can see the large stone there. The temple used to be built around that stone. Now there's a mosque called the Dome of the Rock built around that rock. It's the rock on which Abraham bound his son Isaac for sacrifice. You can walk about 700 yards down the mountain ridge to the Church of the Sepulchre, which is built over Calvary, the place where Jesus was crucified. As Abraham took his only beloved son, Isaac, and laid the wood for Isaac's sacrifice on his shoulders, and led him up the mountain, and bound him on the wood to be sacrificed, God, of course, took his only beloved son, laid the wood for his sacrifice on his shoulders, led him up the mountain, and nailed him to the wood, to the cross, and sacrificed him, because he was the true sacrifice. When Abraham answered his son Isaac, the Lord himself will provide the lamb for the sacrifice, my son, he was speaking prophetically. far more deeply than he knew, because the Lord himself did provide the true lamb for the sacrifice. Now, when Abraham was stopped from sacrificing Isaac, he substituted a ram that was caught in a thicket by its horn, and that was the first Jewish sacrificial lamb. Every Jewish sacrificial lamb from that moment on simultaneously reflected back, looked back at that first Jewish sacrificial lamb, the one that was substituted for Isaac, and looked forward, in a sense, to the true fulfillment of that promise, which was the ultimate sacrificial lamb, which was Jesus. You know that in the Jewish liturgy, in the Jewish synagogue service on the feast days, the Jews blow a shofar, right, a ram's horn. Actually, I don't know if you know that, but it's true. I have one here. This is blown on all of the Jewish major feast days. It's actually blown on the new moon too. And in Jewish theology, the reason they blow this shofar on the feast days is because they are, and this is explicit in Jewish theology, it's blown to remind God, first of all, of Abraham's fidelity and being willingness to sacrifice Isaac, and to remind God of his promise to send the Messiah. They blow the ram's horn to say, essentially, do you remember when our father Abraham was so faithful to you that he was willing to sacrifice his son Isaac, and you promised, therefore, to send the Messiah through his seed? Well, where is he already? And in case any of you have fallen asleep, welcome. So that in Jewish liturgy is actually a plaintive cry to God to send the Messiah. Now, so if that Jewish sacrificial lamb simultaneously points back to that first Jewish sacrificial lamb, when Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son on Mount Moriah, and points forward to the ultimate sacrificial lamb, which was Jesus' sacrifice, you know, God's only son sacrificed on the very same mountain, the central Jewish sacrificial lamb is a Passover lamb. Now, you know, I'm sure, that Passover is a celebration of the Exodus from Egypt. I have to go through the story very briefly. You know that the Jews were slaves to the Pharaoh in Egypt, that God raised up Moses as a deliverer for his people. He sent Moses to the Pharaoh to try to get the Pharaoh to let the Jews go. The Pharaoh refused. God let Moses perform a miracle of plague, send a plague down on the Egyptian people to try to get Pharaoh to release the Jews. It didn't work until the 10th and final plague, which is the slaying of the firstborn. When that happened, the Pharaoh finally let the Jews go. In order for the angel of death not to slay the firstborn of the Jews that first Passover night when the firstborn of all the Egyptians was slain, God told the Jews to slaughter a spring lamb, slaughter a Passover lamb, dip hyssop in the blood of the lamb, and apply it to the lintel and doorposts of their house, the wooden cross piece and vertical piece of the doorway of their house. And that way the angel of death would know that it was a Jewish household and not to visit it and slay the firstborn. That's in fact why it's called Passover. It's because that blood on the doorpost had the angel of death pass over their houses. And then, of course, the Jews were free to leave after that. Now, the Passover in Jewish theology has always been seen as a foreshadowing of the coming of the Messiah. So much so that it's taught as absolute certainty in Jewish theology that when the Messiah comes, he has to come on Passover. Because since the foreshadowing, the picture in advance of the Messiah coming was Passover, the fulfillment of that has to be on Passover. And if you ever go to a Passover Seder, the Passover Seder is a continuous chain of messianic allusions and references. I don't have time to go into it in full, but for instance, there's a place setting for Elijah because there's an expectation that Elijah will come to the Passover Seder. There's a cup of wine that's filled for Elijah. There's a moment in the Seder when the children go to the door and open the door to see if Elijah's there. And the reason they expect Elijah on Passover is because they know from the Old Testament, from Malachi, that Elijah has to come before the Messiah to announce his coming. We know from the New Testament that Jesus himself said, "For those who have ears to hear, John the Baptist came in the power and spirit of Elijah." When the angel announced the birth of John the Baptist to Zechariah, he in fact already told him that John the Baptist would come in the power and spirit of Elijah. I think I actually have that quote, so I don't have to fake it. The angel said to Zechariah, this is from Luke 1, that he will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, which is a quote from Malachi, I believe, 4, which was the prophecy in the Jewish scriptures, which is why the Jews knew that Elijah had to come before the Messiah, which is why the Passover Seder has this expectation of Elijah coming. It has about a half a dozen other messianic expectations in the Passover Seder. Now, so the Passover in Judaism is a picture of the coming of the Messiah, but the Exodus from Egypt is the Exodus in Judaism is a picture of the coming of the Messiah, but the Exodus from Egypt in Christianity is also a picture of the coming of the Messiah. It's a picture in advance of Christianity. This goes back to the Church Father, St. Cyril of Jerusalem, wrote in one of his in mystical, I'm avoiding pronouncing it because I can't, mystagogical catechesis. He goes through the story of the Exodus from Egypt and shows how it's a picture of Christianity, a typological picture. So the reasoning is that the Jews' slavery to Pharaoh in Egypt is a picture of mankind's slavery to Satan because of sin. The Jews were freed from the power of Pharaoh by passing through the waters of the Red Sea, which is a picture of the Christian being freed from the power of Satan by passing through the waters of baptism. The Jews wandered for 40 years through the desert on their way to the Promised Land, which is a picture of the Christian wandering through this life on the way to the true Promised Land, which is, of course, heaven, the heavenly Jerusalem. And the Jews were miraculously fed in the desert by bread from heaven, by the manna in the wilderness, which is a picture of the true miraculous bread from heaven, which feeds the Christian in their journey through the desert of this life on the way to the Promised Land, which of course is the Eucharist. And the equation between the manna in the desert and the Eucharist was made, I think you all know this, but explicitly by Jesus in John chapter 6, in the Bread of Life discourse. Jesus said, "I am the bread of life. Fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh." Let me add one more image to this picture of the essence of Passover. Well, I don't even know if I'm succeeding in this, but what I'm trying to do is simultaneously paint a picture of the Last Supper and the crucifixion, and a picture of the Passover and what the Passover was about, and kind of show that the picture of the Passover is a kind of image in advance of the fulfillment of that image, which was the crucifixion. So let me add one more visual image to that equation, which is the Passover lamb itself. We know from both Jewish and Christian sources how the Passover lamb was prepared for Passover in the days of Jesus. We know it from the Talmud, which is a kind of Jewish canonical scripture from those days, and we also know it from St. Justin Martyr, who was one of the Church Fathers writing in the 2nd century. So let me first read the passage from the Talmud. Thin, smooth staves of wood are driven through the shoulders of the lamb in order to hang it and skin it. And then a skewer of pomegranate wood is thrust through the Passover lamb from its mouth to its buttocks. So one piece of wood would stretch out the forelegs of the lamb, and another piece of wood would stretch it out vertically and be thrust through from its mouth to its buttocks. St. Justin Martyr in the 2nd century AD said, quote, "For the lamb which is roasted and dressed up in the form of a cross. For one spit is transfixed, right through from the lower parts up to the head, and one across the back to which are attached the legs of the lamb." So, it's easy to imagine, and as a matter of fact, it's undoubtedly the case. You can imagine the boy Jesus growing up every Passover at the Passover table, looking at the Passover lamb in the middle of the table, stretched out on a cross, and knowing that he was the fulfillment of that image. He was to be the fulfillment of that image. That's probably actually... Yes, it should stop. That's been almost an hour. Right? So the plan is to, what, take a break and then take questions, or bother?
Let me kind
of jump to the end of this story, which is, I guess you could say, if it's so evident that Christianity and the Catholic Church in particular is the fulfillment of Judaism, why have the Jews been so dense as to not see it? And we have two answers to that, but we have a positive answer to it as well as a negative answer to it. By the way, the true answer, I'll say, is actually the case that's true of almost everybody in every religion, which is 95% of the people in the world follow a religion because they're born into it, because they believe what their parents teach them as their children, and the world around them teaches them, and they don't kind of step outside of it and see whether that's actually the true religion. So I think that's kind of obvious. But St. Paul explains why it's in fact a part of divine providence that Jews did not recognize Christ when he came. And that's the piece that I want to just fill in now. St. Paul describes this primarily in Romans chapter 11. So let me just read some verses from Romans 11 and give a very, very, very like brief overview of why is divine providence, in fact, that the Jews should not recognize Christ en masse until the time immediately before the second coming. And by the way, that's not speculative, it's dogma that that there will be a large scale, wholesale, if you excuse the pun, conversion of the Jews to precede the second coming. Paragraph 674 of the New Catechism of the Catholic Church says, quote, "The glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every moment of history until his recognition by all Israel." Pope Emeritus Benedict actually wrote very beautifully about this in Jesus of Nazareth, this part of the divine plan that there will be a Jews around until the time of the second coming or shortly beforehand, and then there will be a widespread conversion of the Jews. So let me go back to Paul to say why this is the case. This is Romans 11, Paul speaking. "I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. What then? Israel failed to obtain what it sought. The elect obtained it, but the rest were hardened, as it is written. God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see, and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see." Okay, so that's very mysterious. I'll just repeat that. God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see, and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see. So the failure of the Jews to recognize Christ wasn't only due to their stubbornness and hard-heartedness, but was in itself somehow a mysterious part of divine providence. Paul goes on to explain why this might be the case. "So I ask, have they stumbled so as to fall? By no means, but through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles." Through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles. Well, I'll go on with Paul and then I'll go back to that. Now, if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? So what does this mean that through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles? you see what it means if you read the book of Acts. The first crisis in the church that required the first calling of a church council, the Council of Jerusalem around 50 AD, it's described in Acts chapter 15, was to address this urgent problem the church was facing, this critical question they had to resolve, which was, are we allowed to let Gentiles into the church, or is the church only for Jews? Right? That's essentially what required the calling of the Council of Jerusalem. You can see why they were wrestling with this, why many of the early Christians made this error, because Jesus was a Jew, all of the apostles were Jews, virtually everyone Jesus preached to during his life were Jews. In fact, Jesus told his disciples, go nowhere among the Samaritans, go only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. The 3,000 who entered the church on Pentecost Sunday when St. Peter preached to them were all Jews. You know, it's a natural mistake to make. So you look at this, and it's very reasonable to say Jesus was the Jewish Messiah. He came to the Jews. You know, all of his disciples and apostles were Jews. Maybe this is only for Jews. Maybe for a Gentile to enter the church, they have to first be a Jew to qualify. Right? So this was the first crisis in the church. It was resolved to a large extent by the failure of the Jews to enter the church. Because pretty soon, you see this also in Acts, Paul goes everywhere, he preaches first to the Jews, they stone him, they, you know, flog him 39 times, they leave him for dead, he goes to the Gentiles and preaches to them, and they receive him and enter the church. Pretty soon, the church was visibly Gentile, and it was obvious that it was at least as much for Gentiles as for Jews. But if, you know, all of the 5 million Jews in the Roman Empire in those days had, you know, quickly entered the church, it would have been much harder to see that the church was for Jews. For Gentiles. Does that make sense? So anyway, I'll go back to Paul. Now, if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? For if their rejection means the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance mean but life from the dead? So you see, their rejection meant the reconciliation of the world. The Jews' rejection of Jesus meant the reconciliation of the Gentile world to God, that, you know, because they through the church. But if the Jews' rejection meant the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance mean but life from the dead? So, in other words, if the Jews' rejection of Jesus was a blessing for the Gentiles, how much greater will the blessing be when they accept Jesus? Then Paul goes in to his central image to describe this, which is the olive tree. If the root is holy, so are the branches. But if some of the branches were broken off, and you, a wild olive shoot, were grafted in their place to share the richness of the olive tree, do not boast over the branches. If you do boast, remember, it is not you that support the root, but the root that supports you. You will say, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. That's true, but even the others, if they do not persist in their unbelief, will be grafted in, for God has the power to graft them in again. For if you have been cut from what is by nature a wild olive tree, and grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these natural branches be grafted back into their own olive tree? So this is St. Paul's image of Jew and Gentile in the church, right? The olive tree is like the tree of salvation. It grew out of Jewish soil. The root of it was Jewish. Some of the branches were broken off. That's the Jews who failed to follow Christ, were broken off, but they were only broken off to make room to graft in wild olive branches, which were the Gentiles. And if you're one of those grafted in wild olive branches, don't boast over the broken off original olive branches. If you do boast, remember that God has the power to graft them in again. And when he does, how much better will they be suited to the tree because they were originally a part of it. Don't blame me. This isn't me. This is St. Paul. So, but then this is where I will end this, at least my talking to you part of things, which is the end of the chapter. So let me read the end of Romans 11. Lest you be wise in your own conceits, I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all of Israel will be saved. That full number of the Gentiles come in is a reference to essentially the time immediately before the second coming, when the full number of the Gentiles has come in, Jesus talks about it in Luke 23 also in almost the same terms, when the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, and then he immediately goes into a description of the second coming. So let me go back to Romans 11, which is where St. Paul explains why God arranged things this way. As regards the gospel, the Jews are enemies of God, but for your sake. But as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their forefathers. For the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable. Just as you were once disobedient to God, but now have received mercy because of their disobedience, so they have now been disobedient, in order that by the mercy shown to you, they also may receive mercy. For God has consigned all men to disobedience, that he may have mercy upon all. So you see the beauty of this plan of God, right? Because what St. Paul is saying here is that the Gentiles were in a state of disobedience to God before the church. They were out of relationship with God. So when they entered the church, it was obvious that the gift of salvation was an unmerited, sovereign gift of the mercy of God. But the Jews were in relationship with God, and if they had immediately come into the church, they would have thought that they deserved this, that they deserved salvation through the church, because they had always been good, so to speak. So God had to have all men pass through a period of disobedience so that when they do receive the mercy of God, it's evident to them that it's a sovereign gift of God, a sovereign act of mercy on the part of God, and that it's nothing that they did or could have done to deserve it. Does that make sense? You see? So that's really in 45 minutes or whatever, part of the story of the relationship between Jew and Gentile in the church, and the relationship between Judaism and Christianity. And I did write, a 350-page book. I can't be accused of trying to sell it, because I don't have any left to sell. But I did write like a 350-page book about the role of Judaism in salvation history from Abraham to the Second Coming. So there's obviously much more than I could introduce you to tonight. And let me close with a prayer for the conversion of the Jews, which is on the back of these prayer cards, which I have on the table, or will have on the table, and will have enough for everyone, I'm pretty sure. And this is a completely kosher Catholic prayer, because it's actually from the Catholic breviary. It's from the Week for Christian Unity in January, Day 6, which falls on the Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul, used to be dedicated to praying for the conversion of the Jews. And this is the prayer from the breviary for that day. And by the way, I'm praying, this is why I do this, is to generate prayer for the conversion of the Jews in large part. So if you want to resonate with this prayer and pray it interiorly, that's fine. And if you want a prayer card to have the prayer, that's even better. O God, who manifests your mercy and compassion towards all peoples, have mercy upon the Jewish race, from the beginning your chosen people. You selected them alone out of all the nations of the world to be the custodians of your sacred teachings. From them you raised up prophets and patriarchs to announce the coming of the Redeemer. You willed that your only Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, should be a Jew according to the flesh, born of a Jewish maiden in the land of promise. Listen to the prayers we offer you today for the conversion of the Jewish people. Grant that they may come safely to a knowledge and love of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Messiah foretold by their prophets, and that they may walk with us in the way of salvation. Amen. 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 And thank you.
So we'll take Peter first and then James ahead. It's okay, that's fine. Peter.
Thank you. Now, I've got two questions for you, and again, I think a lot of people can remember you from New Dawn and how fantastic it was that some years ago. But and Peter's about to crash there. Salvation history, sin and redemption are characterized in the Old Testament by God's chosen people stepping away from God are coming back according to a familiar pattern. When is the evangelical influence on Capitol Hill fail to see that what Israel is doing now is just a repetition of what has gone before. And secondly, you mentioned, Roy, that Jesus would have seen the stretched out lamb as a young boy and realised that he was to be the fulfilment of this particular sacrifice. We know from the presentation in the temple that Mary would have known this, but surely the Messiah's realisation of his ministry would have unfolded in a gradual linear way as he came to understand the nature of both secular and religious power.
What are you reading from, by the way?
Reading from?
Yeah.
It's just my own
notes. Oh, that's your own notes?
Yeah.
How much Jesus knew and at what point in his life he knew it is an open question. There's no dogma that says, my understanding is, there's no dogma that says he didn't have full knowledge, and there's no dogma that says he did have full knowledge. I do believe that he did have full knowledge, but it's perfectly legitimate to think that he didn't, and that the information, I don't know how to put it, but that he came into knowing about his mission gradually. So that's a perfectly legitimate. In other words, I'm obviously speaking from what I think was the case, but it's not a dogmatic statement. I will say that the idea that he did not know throughout his life is more characteristic recently than it was earlier. And I happen to, this is not necessarily a virtue, but if basically the consensus, the Catholic consensus, was one thing, for many centuries, and only in the 20th century did it change, I'm a little bit suspicious of that change in general. I like the perspective of the Church Fathers. I like the perspective of older tradition. So that's why I adopt that perspective.
Could you just clarify then what the old tradition was that they knew at a very young age, or
it even goes as far as that he it's very I'm not this kind of a theologian, but he had the divine nature and he had the human nature, and the question is where did this knowledge lie, so to speak, and did the merger of those two natures, did his having the divine nature from his birth give him essentially divine knowledge from his birth? And that's really the question.
Well, it could just be what his mother told him.
That's right. So anyway, it's just open to speculation. So I was speculating that he knew what was ahead of him.
Thank you. Thanks for that. James was going to ask a question, and then Kerry after that. James, first of all.
Would I be able to ask a question after?
Okay, you're fine. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your talk. I was wondering, this is maybe too much to ask, but I was wondering if you could maybe talk a bit about the purification laws and the laws of the Jews, because you've mentioned about how the sort of purification laws, the laws of what to eat, etc., etc., were used to sort of keep the Jews separate from the rest of the world, the Gentiles, as it were. Obviously something had to change so that they could go out and so that the Gentiles could come into the church.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you can maybe elaborate on.
Well, the fact that those laws no longer apply was, one place where it was made evident in the New Testament was when St. Peter had the vision of the sheep being lowered from heaven with all of the unclean animals. Do you remember that? He said, I've never eaten these unclean animals, and it was lowered three times, and God said, what I have called clean, you shall not call unclean. And in fact, Jesus said, it's not what goes into your mouth that defiles you, but what comes out of you. The fact that the Jewish laws were abrogated, it's also, the letter to the Hebrews is all about the Jewish sacrificial system being abrogated with the coming of Christ. So that's all over the place, that those laws were never intended to continue after Christ. Does that answer your question, or you wanted to?
Yeah, I mean, is that in the Old Testament that once the Messiah comes?
Oh, hey, this is really neat. I'm trying to answer the question a little sideways. The Old Testament doesn't have anything directly about that. The Old Testament is very mysterious about what's going to happen when the Messiah comes. As you know, there are two sets of prophecies in the Old, messianic prophecies in the Old Testament. The victorious king prophecies, the swords will be beaten into plowshares and the lion will lie down with the lamb and so forth. And also the suffering servant prophecies, the suffering Messiah prophecy. So the Old Testament, I don't know how to put it, but it leaves it shrouded in a lot of mystery what will happen when the Messiah comes. But the Talmud is the Jewish oral tradition, which was written down a couple of centuries after Christ, but supposedly predates Christ, going all the way back to Moses. That's another story, how true that is. But anyway, the Jewish oral tradition says that they ask the question, when the Messiah comes, will we still offer sacrifice? Because in the Old Testament, there are about seven different kinds of sacrifices. There's the sin offering, there's the Thanksgiving offering, and so forth. The answer in the Jewish Talmud is to the question, after the Messiah comes, will sacrifices cease? The answer is all sacrifices will cease after the Messiah comes, except for one, the Thanksgiving sacrifice. What's Eucharist mean? Thanksgiving. Yeah.
I always wonder what it must be like for someone who lives in a way such that it can be a very ritualistic religion as Judaism, that is, I don't mean empty ritual, I mean full of ritual, very rich ritual, and then to come to Catholicism, the rituals of Catholicism, and there, I wonder if there's certain Jews who become Catholics feel a kind of disjoint movement, in a way, moving from one set of rituals to another, or maybe missing certain rituals which still have a lot of meaning and resonance within a Christian framework. Do you personally feel any of that?
If I remember, let me give kind of two answers. What goes on at Mass and what goes on in the synagogue, in the synagogue worship, nothing could fit together better. I mean, it's like bizarre how closely they're mirrored. If you go to a Jewish synagogue, you have the altar, the raised dais. In the middle is the tabernacle, right? A box. In the box is the Torah scroll, which is the Word of God, which is the holiest thing. The rabbi on some feast days takes out the Torah scroll and processes around with the Torah scroll. The parallel, between the tabernacle, because I mean we have the tabernacle, we have the real presence inside the tabernacle. The Jews have the Word of God, which is the closest that they could get to a presence. If the Torah scroll is dropped accidentally, everyone present has to fast because of the sacrilege. When a Torah scroll has to be retired because it's worn out, it's given a burial. It's buried in the earth like a human body. What happens when some of the host gets, it has to be disposed of, it's buried, right? Or the purificator's washed in them. I'm drawing a blank, but it resonates very, very, very neatly, very cleanly with the transformation of the synagogue service is kind of obvious. Even the division of the service into the epistle reading or the Old Testament reading and the gospel reading the Jews have, the first reading is from the prophets. And the second reading is from the Torah. The Torah is, like, the Jew is the Torah, but the Gospel is the Christians. The Torah is the heart of it. The Torah is the most holy part. But the first reading is from the kind of secondary part and so forth. So it's really very parallel. The feast days are a little bit harder because I do miss... I pray for the conversion of the Jews, basically. And I feel... I feel Jewish prayer in me, and so I do sometimes pray the Jewish feast days, but I pray them in the context of the Catholic Church being the fulfillment of Judaism, and I pray them in the context of praying for the conversion of the Jews. And I've even been known to go to synagogue services like on Yom Kippur, which are the holiest day of the year, and surrounded by all of these Jews who are very thirsty for God, you know, who are working very hard at knowing God. And, you know, my heart breaks because, you know, he's just waiting for them in such a fullness that they have, can't even imagine. And so, you know, that's an opportunity to kind of pray for, you know, for them to come into the fulfillment of the promise. It's really sad. I talked in the beginning of my talk about what the Jews were. So obviously the Jews were the people who prayed for the coming of the Messiah for 2,000 years, who hungered for the coming of the Messiah for 2,000 years, who sacrificed for the coming of the Messiah for 2,000 years. If there is a special Jewish spiritual nature, I'm not saying there is, but if there is, it would be a particular hunger for the Messiah. Because that's why God made them. And that hunger, you know, can't be met without Christ and without the Eucharist. And so it's just really sad.
I was just something to add. Actually, it's my relatives that work with Aborigines, and what they were saying was, now they're not Catholic, they're evangelical. Now they've worked on islands, remote islands, coming to tribal Aborigines in Australia, and they've also worked with tribes in Africa, conversion. But what we were told was that although they were in tribes and they were very much ritualistic, they all knew Jesus Christ, they knew he existed, they didn't know his name, but every single non-Christian faith or way of life, they actually do know Christ, but they don't know him by name. It's just when you're talking about the Old Testament, you're saying that the Jews do know, but it's just putting into the context.
That's a very good point. If I can say, I mean, I've read a number of witness testimonies of shamans from South America who came to Christianity and so forth. I think that's a little bit of a complicated issue because those primitive tribes actually have more of an awareness of the spiritual world than we do and that Jews today do. So how much of their knowledge of Christ, my understanding is their knowledge of Christ actually comes from their knowledge of the spiritual world.
It differs between Africa and Australia,
okay. That
one, but I don't know, I mean, there was something I read, and it was basically what they were saying is you don't have to be Catholic to get to heaven.
Well, that's the teaching of the
Jews
church.
Will go in, it's don't need to, because they do know Christ in a way.
The church clearly teaches you don't have to be Catholic to go to heaven. But it also teaches that the reason you don't have to know Christ to go to heaven or don't have to be Catholic to go to heaven is because basically you do the best you can with the life that's been given you, that's good enough. So if the life's been given you to know about Christ and to know that the Catholic Church is the truth, at that point you do need the Catholic Church to go to heaven because you have to be faithful to what's been given to you to the fullest extent you can, right?
Yeah, and also the Second Vatican Council says that even though you don't, it's much more dangerous if you don't, because you're much more liable to be led astray if you don't know Christ in person. So there's a kind of a one-sided, almost relativist view, is that since the Second Vatican Council said that the Church always in a sense taught it, was more clear about it, that those who don't know Christ may be saved if they follow immediately after that, say, but they are much more prone to danger than those to do and have the light of the gospel, the light of the truth. So which is still why there's this pressing need for evangelisation, obviously. Thanks very much. Peter?
Yeah, this actually mostly links in with the last question. It was in your talk and in your answer to one of the earlier questions, especially when you're talking about going on Yom Kippur, Second Poor, and praying for Jewish people who had this rebirth for God. And in your talk, you mentioned specifically that it is part of God's plan that Jews do remain, that there are Jews en masse until the second coming of Christ, and so it's God's will that possibly these Jews, the Jews we were praying with, remain Jews. So I suppose the first part of the question would be, when you pray for the conversion of Jews, is it you pray for what is the real, do you know what I mean?
I do. It's a very good point. And I mean, you're dead on. There is an apparent paradox there, or contradiction there. I think it's only apparent because Jesus gave us our instructions, right? Go out and make disciples of all nations, beginning in Jerusalem. I mean, in other words, I think the resolution is we have to evangelize. We have to share the faith. We have to try to bring people into the truth. But we can't blame them if they fail to receive the grace to know it's the truth. Right? In other words, they're not culpable, and maybe they haven't received the grace. Maybe God has, kept them, let their hearts be hard and so they cannot see and so forth. Maybe, we shouldn't blame them for not seeing it, but our job is to show it to them.
I think tying in with that question, Roy, is this idea that the promise hasn't been revoked. Is it exactly the same promise? You know, there's some theologians who say that the promise that the Christians have grasped is there's this speculation about a parallel promise that the Jewish people, which is providential, that only the end will come together, and so that there's a providence. I think that's Peter's point. There's a providence in them remaining unconverted.
Yeah, that's right. I tried to talk about that, it does seem to be divine providence, but that doesn't change our job. All it means is that we should not blame them if they don't. And I'll say something else, which is, especially if we are close to the time of the second coming, then you definitely don't want to be in the position of not evangelizing the Jews, because that's exactly when they have to be brought into the church for the second coming to happen. And I do it, I don't do it eschatologically, and I don't do it, I know how unhappy I was before I found out the truth. And I my family is still Jewish. I have all the friends that I had growing up. I basically know how unhappy it is and how tragic it is to have that thirst for God and have so little of it. Even Judaism doesn't make sense without the Catholic faith. That's really true. The Jews know they're the chosen people and that somehow they're supposed to save the world, but they had no answer to how and what that means. I mean, we know what that meant, right? Because Jesus came through them. I don't know how to put it, but anyway, being Jewish myself, I know that simply as an act of charity, I have to have a heart for the conversion of the Jews, because I know how miserable I was and I know how miserable they are not having what they could have. So
I think at that point, I know this